You wouldn't expect 10 highly experienced chefs to cook the identical meal just because you handed them the exact same basket of ingredients.
No, of course not. That would be ridiculous.
Right. Because their choices are going to be fundamentally shaped by, like, their years of training, their specific culinary preferences, and crucially, who they are actually cooking for tonight.
Yeah, the audience matters a lot.
Exactly. Yet millions of real estate investors look at the exact same market data, the exact same interest rates, and the exact same property listings, and they just assume there is a singular, universal best property out there to buy.
It is one of the most pervasive illusions in the whole industry, honestly. People assume the asset itself holds objective value, completely divorced from the actual person buying it.
Yeah, exactly. And today, our mission for this deep dive is to tear down that myth. We are fundamentally shifting the focus from the exhausting, impossible question of, like, what is the best property, to a much more powerful, mathematically sound question, which is, what is the best strategy for your specific goals?
Which is a huge mental shift for a lot of people.
It really is. And to do this, we are pulling from a highly detailed framework titled FOUR: Building a Property Investment Strategy That Matches Your Financial Goals, along with some phenomenal supplementary research we have on the mechanics of due diligence and fractional ownership.
Right, because property investing, just like cooking, is entirely dependent on the person wearing the apron.
I love that.
What's fascinating here is that without a clear underlying strategy, investors aren't actually investing at all. They are just reacting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
They see a flashy commercial property or read some headline about a booming suburban neighborhood, and the FOMO just kicks right in. They commit massive amounts of capital based on the excitement of the opportunity rather than its actual utility within a larger, structured, long-term plan.
Right, which brings us to the most counterintuitive part of this entire process, I think. If you want to succeed in real estate, the starting line is actually the finish line.
Oh, absolutely. Like, before you open a single property listing, before you look at mortgage rates or walk through an open house, you have to define the exact destination you are trying to reach.
Because if you don't define the destination, I mean, any road will get you there, but you will almost certainly hate the neighborhood you end up in.
That is so true.
Let's look at the actual market mechanics of this. Two investors can buy identical duplexes right next door to each other for the exact same purchase price. Fast forward 5 years, and one investor considers the asset a massive success, while the other views it as a catastrophic failure.
Just based on their goals.
Exactly, because their initial goals were entirely different. The text contrasts two classic profiles, right? You have the investor prioritizing reliable, passive rental income versus the investor prioritizing aggressive long-term capital growth.
Okay, let's unpack this because I know a lot of experienced people listening right now might be rolling their eyes just a bit.
Sure.
Like, in a perfect world, sure, you match the property to the goal, but markets are volatile and equity is equity. If I buy a property solely for long-term growth and its value drops 20% in the first 2 years due to, macroeconomic shifts, isn't that just a bad property regardless of my 20-year horizon?
I hear that all the time.
Shouldn't any investor be upset by that?
Well, it is completely natural to be upset by a dip in valuation, sure. But a drop in market price doesn't mechanically invalidate the asset if your timeline is 20 years.
Because you aren't selling it today.
Exactly. If you don't need to sell the asset today, that 20% drop is unrealized. It's just a paper loss. If that same property is structurally sound, located in an area with strong municipal development plans, and is covering its baseline carrying costs, it is still performing its function within a growth strategy.
Okay, I see what you mean.
Compare that to the passive income investor. They don't care if the property value doubles in 10 years, honestly. They need a predictable yield of 8% right now to supplement their current lifestyle. Right. So for the cash flow investor, a high-growth property that barely covers its own monthly maintenance is a nightmare, because it starves them of the liquidity they actually rely on to live.
Precisely.
And for the growth investor, a high-yield property in a stagnant market is just as bad, because inflation is just eating away at the principal over the long term.
Yeah, neither goal is inherently superior. They just solve entirely different financial equations. The source guide actually links out to a great technical breakdown called How to Evaluate an Investment Property Before You Invest.
Oh yeah, I read that one.
It emphasizes how veteran investors use these predefined goals as a rigorous filter. When you have a strict framework, you don't just blindly react to a headline claiming a specific zip code is the next big thing.
You actually test it.
Right.
Yeah.
You run the data through your model and ask, does the capitalization rate on this property serve my specific need for yield, or do the historical appreciation metrics serve my need for growth? If it doesn't fit the math, you walk away.
Which naturally leads us to the other side of that coin. If your goal tells you where you are driving, your risk tolerance dictates how you handle the bumps along the way.
That's a great way to look at it.
I like to think about it in terms of like automotive engineering. Risk in real estate isn't just about the market crashing, it's about the shock absorbers you build into your strategy.
I love that analogy.
Yeah, like a long-time horizon is a massive shock absorber. But a short-time horizon is like riding a bicycle over a pothole. You're going to feel every single bump.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, quantifying risk tolerance is what separates institutional-grade strategies from amateur speculation. The text provides a great baseline comparison of two distinct investor profiles who have the exact same starting capital.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Let's say they both have $100,000 in liquid cash to deploy.
So the starting line is identical, but the shock absorbers are completely different.
Exactly. Investor A is in their early 30s, working a stable corporate job, and they're deploying this capital for a retirement that is 30 years away.
Okay, makes sense.
But investor B is in their late 40s and needs to extract that capital plus a return in exactly 5 years to fund a transition into starting their own business.
I want to pause here and ask you, the listener, directly which one are you right now? Look at your own capital. What is the actual structural timeline for the money you are putting to work?
It is the most important question you can ask.
Because if you build identical real estate portfolios for these two different lives, it would be an absolute disaster.
A verifiable disaster, yeah. Investor A, with 30 years on the clock, has incredible shock absorbers. They can afford to acquire properties in emerging, highly volatile neighborhoods.
Because they have time to recover.
Right. They can weather a 5-year economic downturn where property values plummet because they have decades for the market cycle to recover and eventually peak.
But investor B, who needs that liquidity in 60 months if the market tanks in year four, their capital is entirely trapped.
Yes. They either have to sell at a devastating loss, completely wiping out their business plan, or they are forced into expensive, high-interest bridge loans.
Which is a terrible position to be in.
Which is why investor B needs predictability above all else. They need assets in established, highly stable markets with guaranteed long-term corporate tenants. The yield might be significantly lower, but the principal is protected.
So the crucial takeaway here is that defining your risk tolerance mathematically before you commit capital is your ultimate defense against emotional trading.
Exactly. When the market inevitably corrects, you don't panic and sell at the absolute bottom if you have already structurally accounted for that volatility in your time frame.
Right. If you know your vehicle is built to handle the terrain, a few rocks in the road don't make you abandon the car. So if your timeline is your shock absorber, how do you actually know what kind of potholes you're about to drive over? Because you can't just guess.
You certainly can't. And this is where the romance of real estate investing usually hits a brick wall of reality.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because the biggest misconception in real estate is that the work begins when you step foot inside a building to view it.
Oh, not even close.
Right. But the most critical phase of property investing actually happens in the dark. It's the hidden work. Long before an offer is drafted, the professionals are buried in spreadsheets and municipal records.
Yes, the hidden work. In the industry, we call this the due diligence period, but it's much more than just a simple home inspection.
Gets way deeper than that.
Experienced investors spend the vast majority of their time in this hidden phase. They aren't just looking at Zillow estimates.
No.
They are deeply analyzing the underlying mechanics of a local economy.
Break that down for us a bit. What does that hidden work actually look like mechanically? Because it's not just checking if the roof leaks.
Not at all. It's an exhaustive, multi-layered audit. The experts explicitly point to a supplementary article titled A Practical Property Due Diligence Checklist for Investors.
Which is a fantastic resource, by the way.
It really is. This involves a financial audit, so you are comparing the seller's projected pro forma income against the actual trailing 12 months of expenses to spot discrepancies.
Just to make sure they aren't cooking the books.
Exactly. And it involves a legal audit, running deep title searches for hidden liens and reviewing local zoning laws. I mean, if you are buying a property for long-term residential appreciation, but the municipal board just quietly zoned the adjacent 5 acres for heavy industrial manufacturing, your investment is dead on arrival.
Wow. Which really shifts the perspective on what due diligence is actually supposed to achieve. Because the goal isn't to somehow magically eliminate every single risk. That's impossible. Real estate is inherently risky.
Always.
The goal of this rigorous hidden work is to transition your risk from an unknown variable to a known quantifiable variable.
Precisely. You want to make decisions based on verifiable data rather than gut assumptions. Thorough preparation equals post-investment confidence.
Yeah, that peace of mind is huge.
If you track migration patterns, analyze local employment diversity, and audit the financials thoroughly, you significantly reduce your exposure to catastrophic surprises. You identify the assets that genuinely align with your predefined strategy rather than the ones that just look aesthetically pleasing in a broker's marketing brochure.
Okay, adapting to the current data is great in theory. You've done the hidden work, you know your risk profile, and you finally close on the perfect asset that aligns with your current life. But here is the problem. Traditional real estate is incredibly static, but human life is anything but.
That is perhaps the most dangerous myth in the entire sector, honestly. The concept of the fixed strategy.
The idea that it just never changes.
Yeah, the illusion that once a portfolio strategy is minted, it is carved in stone for eternity.
Because over 20 years, the person who got that property is going to fundamentally change. Like, their income bracket shifts, they might have children, they might be supporting aging parents.
Life happens, you know.
Right. The 30-year-old who aggressively pursued high-growth, high-risk assets is eventually going to turn 50 and likely want the stability of passive monthly yield.
Exactly. The strategy must be a living document because the macroeconomic environment is continuously shifting right alongside your personal life.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, if interest rates double over a 5-year period, the cost of capital fundamentally changes the viability of your existing assets.
So what does this all mean for the investor? How do you practically tell the difference between thoughtfully evolving your strategy to match your new life circumstances and just panic shifting because the Federal Reserve made a terrifying announcement on a Tuesday?
That distinction is what separates institutional success from retail failure. Experienced investors manage this through highly structured periodic reviews of their portfolios.
So they don't just react to the news?
No, never. But the key metric of that review isn't just market performance, it's personal alignment. They review the plan to see if it still serves their personal future, not the current media speculation.
Meaning, if your 20-year goal hasn't changed, a 3-month spike in interest rates shouldn't make you liquidate your entire portfolio.
Exactly. You don't abandon a structural long-term plan because of short-term market noise. Whiplashing your capital from one strategy to another incurs massive transactional friction.
Like taxes and fees.
Yeah, taxes, closing costs, broker fees that will bleed your wealth dry. But if your actual underlying life circumstances have materially changed, you execute a calculated pivot.
That's a good way to phrase it.
The source material references Investopedia's Guide to Investment Strategies to illustrate this. It details the mechanics of how investors use tools like 1031 exchanges to defer capital gains taxes when they transition their equity from high-growth assets into stable, cash-flowing multifamily units later in life.
Wow, so it's a very intentional transition.
It's about gracefully detouring your capital as your life unfolds, without derailing the overarching wealth-building process.
I love that framing. It's a calculated pivot, not a panic response. But even with a living strategy, there is an enormous unavoidable hurdle in traditional real estate. Physical property is incredibly illiquid and astronomically expensive.
It really is.
Like, if my carefully calibrated strategy requires me to diversify across 3 different geographic markets to mitigate risk, but each property requires a 20% down payment, my capital is going to be exhausted almost immediately.
For most people, yeah.
I'm forced to put all my eggs into one massive brick-and-mortar basket simply because of the barrier to entry.
This is a profound structural barrier, and it is exactly why the investment vehicle you choose is just as important as the destination itself. The text introduces fractional property ownership to solve this exact liquidity and diversification crisis.
And structurally, how does this actually work? Because we aren't talking about timeshares here.
No, definitely not timeshares.
We are talking about fundamentally changing real estate from a localized binary asset where you either own the entire building or you don't into a fluid, borderless portfolio.
That is the perfect way to describe it. Traditionally, you know, you are buying the deed. You carry the mortgage, the maintenance, the liability.
All the headaches.
Exactly. Mm. In a fractional ownership model, an entity, usually a special purpose vehicle or an LLC, purchases and manages the physical asset. You, as the investor, purchase digital shares or fractions of that entity.
Okay, I'm following.
So you own a proportionate stake in the income-generating asset without having your personal credit tied up in the underlying debt.
Which completely changes the math on diversification.
Oh, completely.
Like if I have $50,000, instead of sinking it all into one down payment on a single duplex in my own zip code, I can deploy $10,000 across five different commercial and residential assets in five entirely different cities.
Drastically reducing your geographic and asset class risks. This lowers the barrier to entry so significantly that investors can begin executing complex, diversified strategies immediately.
Rather than waiting years to save up.
Right. Rather than waiting a decade to accumulate enough capital for a single traditional down payment.
And this ties beautifully back into our first point about matching the strategy to the person. Because fractional ownership behaves completely differently depending on the user.
That's a great point.
For a younger investor, it's the ultimate starting line. It gets their capital into the market, compounding immediately. But for an older, high net worth investor who already owns five physical buildings, fractional ownership isn't a starting line.
No, it's a completely different tool for them.
Right. It's a sophisticated tool to gain exposure to industrial real estate or international markets without over-leveraging their cash reserves.
It is the ultimate strategic chameleon. The sources highlight Osul Gamma's philosophy regarding this, which emphasizes that successful fractional investing fundamentally begins with deep mechanical understanding.
So they aren't just selling a product.
No, their priority isn't just offering accessibility. It is educating the investor on how to surgically apply these shares to their unique goal.
That's vital.
For those wanting to dig into the exact legal and structural mechanics of how these shared asset vehicles operate, the text guides you to a comprehensive breakdown titled Fractional Ownership versus REITs. Understanding the differences before you invest.
Because it's never about buying into a new vehicle just because it's innovative or accessible.
Absolutely not.
It is strictly about asking the data, like, does the structure of this specific asset accelerate my timeline or protect my downside risk better than traditional ownership?
It all comes back to the strategy every single time.
So to synthesize this entire deep dive, a property investment strategy provides the one thing market data cannot give you. Direction.
Yeah, you need that compass.
This game is not about predicting the macroeconomic future, because you literally can't. It is not about discovering a hidden, universally perfect property, because that doesn't exist.
It really doesn't.
And it is certainly not a sheer volume contest to see who can acquire the most square footage. It is about deploying a rigorous mathematical framework to make consistent, unemotional choices that serve the specific life you were trying to build over the next 20 years.
This raises an important question, though. When the dust settles, who actually wins in the real estate market?
I think people have a lot of misconceptions about that.
They do. When you look at the historical data, the most successful investors are rarely the ones taking the most aggressive, highly leveraged risks or making the flashiest acquisitions. The true winners are simply the most patient, disciplined players on the board.
They just stick to the plan.
Exactly. They are the individuals who ruthlessly quantify their personal goals, build shock absorbers for their specific risk profiles, do the grueling hidden work, and then tune out the noise of the market to let their strategy compound over decades.
They don't try to outsmart the market. They just let the underlying mechanics of their strategy do the heavy lifting. Now, as we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over as you audit your own portfolio.
Oh, this should be good.
We spent this entire time talking about aligning your asset strategy with your personal life goals. But think about the eventual legacy of that strategy. If you are building generational wealth to pass down, how does the actual format of the asset change the people who inherit it?
That's a fascinating angle.
Right. If you pass down physical, tangible real estate like a massive building that requires active management, tenant relations, and constant upkeep versus passing down frictionless digital shares of a fractional asset, does that change the way the next generation views and interacts with their wealth?
It definitely changes the burden of management.
Yeah, does inheriting a localized physical burden instill a different financial psychology than inheriting a fluid digital portfolio? Something deeply structural to think about as you construct your blueprint.
Something to think about for sure.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep researching, keep refining your models, and most importantly, keep asking the hard questions.